You're listening to KRU UFP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond, grassroots, listener-supported, community-powered, and solar-powered radio. The only solar-powered radio here in the Midwest, broadcasting live from the Cultural District in sunny Fairfield, Iowa.
It's nice to see the sun again after all that rain, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it was nice to see the rain after all that drought.
Oh, yeah.
And this is Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilbourne. We're back from our adventure in Rome.
Right.
Mom's first time out of the country.
Yes. Probably the last.
You never know. You never know. You're only 82. You've got plenty of time.
Okay.
Okay.
You know, it's funny because there's a Rome, Iowa, which is between here and Mount Pleasant.
Right,
and so when
right.
I say Rome, people say, oh, you went to Rome. They were thinking Rome.
No way. No way.
It's a very small town. Very small town.
And Rome, Italy, of course, is quite an experience.
Yes, it is. It's a whole other world.
Yeah.
Let's face it.
Yeah. So, Mom, speaking of other worlds, who are we bringing to our world today?
Well, this is a book that anyone who wants to write, thinks they want to write, thinks they ought to write, should read.
Ever thought they wanted to write.
Exactly. 52 Insights and Actions to Boost Your Creative Mojo. Pep Talks for Writers by Grant Faulkner, and it is really good.
And tell us a little bit about Grant before we bring him on.
Okay, all righty. Grant Faulkner likes big stories and small stories. He is executive director of National Novel Writing Month and the co-founder of 100 Word Story. His stories have appeared in dozens of literary magazines, including Tin House, The Southwest Review, and Puerto del Sol. His essays on creativity have been published in the New York Times, Poets and Writers, Writer's Digest, and The Writer. He recently published a collection of 100 word stories called Fissures, and he lives in Berkeley, California. And he's originally from
Oskaloosa, Iowa. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Grant, and welcome back to Iowa, even, kind of virtually.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to our chat.
So let's start with, National Novel Writing Month. How did you get involved? Tell for those who may not be familiar with it, tell us a little bit about what it is and how you got involved.
Yeah, it's a fascinating event. It's more than an event, though. It's a community. But at the basics, it's a challenge to write 50,000 words in 30 days in November. And so, that's about 1,700 words a day. And part of the reason we do it is that we believe that everyone has a story to tell. But so often people wait and they say, I'm going to write that story someday. Well, someday just rarely happens, right?
Right.
So we want to make that happen today. So in order to make that happen, a big goal and a deadline is a motivator, mm-hmm. It puts pressure on you to finish that draft. And the premise is that by writing 50,000 words, you're just getting it out. You're just getting the story out, and you're experimenting and finding your story, really. And so many people set up a whole variety of obstacles between themselves and the novel they want to write. But one of those biggest obstacles is just like people think that, oh, the words I write, they don't measure up to my favorite authors. Well, the thing with our favorite authors is we never get to read their rough drafts, right?
Right.
And their rough drafts are rough. They're as rough as ours. So, you have to trust in yourself that just writing it, don't worry about perfectionism, banish your inner editor, write those 50,000 words, and then you can revise later. And so my involvement, at least as a writer, was way back in 2009, and I had been writing for years and years, and I felt like I was in a creative rut. I kind of wondered, did I choose my creative process, or did it choose me? So I thought, this is the time to do an experiment, shake it up, just for the sake of shaking it up. So I did NaNoWriMo, and what I found was that I took more creative risks. When I wrote a novel with NaNoWriMo, I found that more ideas lead to better ideas. So by writing that rough draft with such pressure on me and really focusing on progress, it really, really opened up the flow of experimentation. So I found that it made me a better writer and that I was actually testing ideas much more effectively through NaNoWriMo.
Interesting. Now, we had Chris Beatty on the show a couple years ago, he was the founder, right?
Yeah, right. Chris is the founder. He founded it in 1999. He had no true vision that it was going to become the creative phenomena that it is. I mean, this year we're going to have about 350,000 people sign up to write.
Oh, wow.
Program. Wow. And then we have our Young Writers Program, where about 80,000 kids and teens will sign up, and we support 5,000 classrooms across the country to teach novel writing. So, he invited 20 of his friends back in 1999 to write a novel with him. And the next year, in 2000, 150 people showed up. One, they built a rudimentary website, and 5,000 people showed up, and then we've just kept growing. So we see evidence that most people really do have a story they want to tell.
Now, you go sign up on the site, and how is there, you said that it put pressure on you. How does it exert pressure on the writers? Is it just...
Well, so you got the deadline. Okay. The goal is 50,000 words. You got 30 days to do it. So that's 1,700 words a day, and so that's the pressure. You've got to keep your word count moving forward. And I think a lot of writers, again, this is the type of writer I was before I did NaNoWriMo. I would just spend so much time writing and rewriting my first chapter to make it perfect before moving on. And I could literally probably spend a lifetime just writing that first chapter.
So you get stuck.
The thing that makes this an ineffective writing process is that it's likely that by the time you write your first... Joyce Carol Oates says you can't write your first sentence until you write your last sentence. Mm. So, that first chapter that I'd spent so much time on, it was very ineffective to spend so much time on that. You know, it's better just to get the whole rough draft out and then revise it later, because you're going to be making so many crucial decisions after you've written the rough draft.
That's a good point. Now, of the 350,000 people who sign up, how many will actually meet the goal?
Yeah, so we've been doing this a long time now, and we have a pretty good idea. We're always trying to get more people to succeed, of course, but about 15%, roughly. So there will be nearly 50,000 new novels in the world at the end of November.
Whoa. Well, first drafts of new
first
novels.
First drafts, yeah.
Yes, yeah. And you've had some success stories of people who started out that way and went on to have best-selling books.
Absolutely, yeah. We've had hundreds of books that have been traditionally published out of NaNoWriMo, thousands that have been self-published, and many bestsellers, including Sarah Gruen's Water for Elephants that was made into a popular film with Reese Witherspoon, Hugh Howey's Wool, Aaron Morgenstern's Night Circus. Marissa Meyer has written nearly all of her books with us. it is amazing.
And there's local chapters for people to actually get together and write during this month?
Definitely, yeah. We have 1,000, I call them super volunteers. Their official title is municipal liaisons. And they are in places they're around the world, but we have pretty good coverage, especially in the United States. So I haven't looked at the map in Iowa this year, but I know we always have a strong central Iowa presence. The municipal liaison in Des Moines, I know she actually comes to my hometown and usually hosts a write-in sometime during November, and she live streams those write-ins to include people who can't make it.
Oh, cool.
So I don't know there might be somebody in Fairfield, actually. We accept volunteers, so... If you want to organize a nano chapter there, just contact us.
Yeah, she needs something else to do.
Pick for it.
Yeah. So, Grant, 52 insights and actions to boost your creative mojo, pep talks for writers. How did this book come about?
Did you have a question?
Yeah, how did this book come about?
I didn't hear that. Yeah. How did it come out? Yeah. That's a good question. Since I've been executive director of National Novel Writing Month, I talk to so many people who really find themselves as creators and writers during NaNoWriMo, and they want to keep going because NaNoWriMo establishes this wonderful creative momentum. But it can be hard. It's like when the people who sign up to go for a gym membership in January, and I forget the percentage, but something like 70 to 80% of them have stopped showing up within a month or two.
Yeah.
And I think that happens really easily for writers as well. And so that's why there are 52 essays, is I really want to help people continue to be creative year-round and to continue writing their novels or other projects and to really develop a creative mindset.
Mm-hmm. Of course, part of the problem is people have to make a living and they have to go to work and they have to take care of...
They do have those little nuisances.
And they have to take care of their families.
Yeah.
And eat and sleep.
The book actually leads with this quote from Picasso that every child is born an artist. The challenge is how to remain an artist as we grow old. And it is a challenge, right? I mean, just as you said, we've got jobs to take care of. We've got houses to take care of. We might have kids to take care of. You know, life becomes really busy, and it becomes so busy that our creativity falls lower and lower on our list and maybe entirely off the list.
Yeah.
So part of this book addresses those practicalities, like how do you develop a creative mindset in a busy life? How do you manage to be creative every day, whether it's on the paper, on the page, or off the page? And I think it can be done. I think we just need to make creativity more of a priority, and we need to attune ourselves to we need to seize creative moments and be able to recognize them and invite them into our lives and also make them happen through our own routines.
Of course, the things that you can do now that we couldn't do about 50 years ago, let's record as you're driving along, you can record things, you know, and I mean, there's a lot of possibilities here.
It's true. You know, we are blessed with technology that keeps providing more and more tools for writers. I mean, when I first, just to date myself, I was one of the last people who went to college with a typewriter. And I decided to be a writer, you know, when I was 20. And so my first few years, actually, after college, I was still using a typewriter to type my stories. So it's been, you know, it's marvelous now to have this high-speed laptop and all this fancy writing software that really helps as well. But I think, like, when you mentioned, like, the voice, you know, I think we need to get inventive in our lives to seize those creative moments. So, yeah, whether it's technology, like recording ideas while you're driving, or if it's, you know, like one thing for in order to prepare for National Novel Writing Month, I always recommend that people have a strategy going in. And part of that strategy, a big part of it, is really a time management strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And I do it every year. And what I do is I take a week and I break it down into half-hour chunks, and I keep track of how I spend all my time. And I find that there's more time in my life than I imagined. For instance, if I get off of social media, that opens up a big...
Oh, Lord, yes.
If I decide to, well, for 5 or 10 minutes at a lunch break, if I decide to, you know, again, do that like before going to bed, if I wake up an hour earlier, like my life as a working parent, I say that I have to write in the nooks and crannies of the day. And there are those nooks and crannies available to us if we really search for them. One of my favorite stories is about Toni Morrison, and she was a working parent. This is before she ever published a novel, and living in New York City, a high-pressure job, and after she took care of her kids at night, she had about 15 minutes to herself. Still exhausted, but she used those 15 minutes to write, and that's how she wrote her first novel.
Wow.
The big things are built in small increments, and I think that sometimes we think, oh, I need that perfect writing space. I need to have 2 or 3 hours a day, and I'll write my novel, you know, after I've retired, and that's when I'll, you know, have plenty of time. But that perfect time, I've never seen it happen. I think you got to make time.
And, of course, when I hear stories like that, then it makes me feel guilty for all the time that I've wasted.
Well, we all come to reckonings moments of enlightenment. I that's life, right?
Yeah.
It's not about the regret. It's about making it happen now and learning from your past.
You know, you're talking about, you know, social media, and of course that can be such a time. I mean, I go to look at my phone in the morning to see what the temperature's going to be and end up spending 15 minutes on Twitter.
Exactly.
And it's like, I didn't mean to do that.
Right.
And I heard on NPR yesterday, an interview with someone who had done this research project about the impact of just having your phone on your desk, even if it's turned off, that for many people, their cognitive ability goes down.
Yeah. We, you know, these phones and so many things online, they are very skillfully developed in order to be addictive. And I think they, you know, sometimes we have to realize that we have to recognize our own addictions and how, you know, I call the phones and social media, it's like the sirens, right?
Yes.
The sirens are calling you, and they're seducing you to come over. But it's sometimes more than that, really. It is a true addiction, and I definitely notice it in myself. I notice it in my kids, and I think we have to work really hard to moderate those forces in our life, because, you know, so often, I mean, actually, since you mentioned Chris Beatty, last time I was talking with him, you know, he was mentioning that most of the time he reaches for his phone after he does whatever on it, he feels worse.
Yeah.
I was recognizing that, too. I was like, wow, so often I feel worse afterwards.
And even
I would feel better if I had spent that time writing.
Even if you're resisting the siren's call,
yeah,
there's mental energy you're expending in the resistance.
Exactly. Exactly. So I do think like this is a moment in our history as human beings dealing with technology where we really need to take a very energetic and purposeful kind of stance towards it. If we're actually going to be fulfilled in our lives.
That
especially goes for writers.
There's this cool invention that allows you to write anywhere, whether you have electricity, whether you have a device with you or not. You can write absolutely anywhere. And it's called...
Wow, what is that?
It's called paper.
And pencil.
Wow.
I know. Can you imagine? You have no limits.
It's
amazing.
Like if you don't have email and people say, you don't have email. I said, no, but you can pick up the phone, you know.
I know. Imagine that. Have a conversation. Yeah. You know, technology allows people to talk.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. So... You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our very entertaining guest today is Grant Faulkner, author of Pep Talks for Writers. So how many of these pep talks have to do with time management?
Gosh, I haven't tallied that up, but I think they do cover a number of themes of the writer's life, and certainly like time management or dealing with technology is a part of the essays. I mean, there are dedicated chapters to them as well. But they, you know, it weaves through so many, you know, I tried to touch the whole, as many aspects of living the creative life as I could in it. So, for instance, just to go with our conversation here, the theme that we've been talking about, there is a chapter on boredom.
Yes.
And how boredom is a scarce resource these days. It used to be an abundant resource before the technology. And when I say it was an abundant resource, it was like, boredom is good for us. You know, boredom is when your mind quiets down. Your mind is always searching for stimulation and ideas and daydreaming. And so too often when I'm standing in line at the grocery store waiting for a cup of coffee, I reach for my phone. But that is a creative opportunity, you know. Like I have that moment to be, to create a moment of presence in the world and to be attuned to myself and those around me. So whether I'm eavesdropping on a conversation or observing other people or daydreaming, that's a wonderful thinking time. And I think that too often we don't allow that thinking time to really be used well because of technology. So I advise, like, if you're bored, that's a good thing.
You know, this is 52 pep talks, and you would think it would be a volume of a book, but it's not. And that's because you have kept them short, and that's good. It's really good because if people are, for instance, here's one. You are what you wear, okay? That's intriguing to me, and I didn't want to read 8 or 10 pages about it, you know, just, let's see, how many pages is there? 1.5 pages.
That wouldn't be good boredom. That would be bad boredom if I had 8 or 10 pages right on that topic.
Well, what is, you are what you wear, what does that, how does that impact writers?
Yeah, that's one of the more playful chapters in the book, but it's also meaningful, I think, because... I think like one theme that runs through the book is how do we define ourselves as authors? How do we both make that statement to the world at large, and how do we make that statement to ourselves? Because I believe that you have to really embrace that I am a real writer. You know, you define yourself as a writer by writing, not through publishing or awards or other people's esteem. And so you are what you wear. You know, they've actually proved this in psychological studies that when you dress differently, you sort of inhabit a different persona. And they even gave people, I think one of the studies, they gave, you know, 50% of the people like lab coats, those white, you know, medical coats, and the other 50% just dressed it as normal. And what they found is that the people wearing the lab coats were much more serious and focused and thoughtful and responsible.
Smarter
maybe, yeah, just by what they wear. So I feel like if you're, as an author, you know, you're mainly an author on the page or on your laptop, But you're, you know, I think you also need to, like, signal to yourself and even the world who you are as an author. And so I think, you know, purchase clothes, dress like the author you want to be, you know. There are, of course, an infinite number of ways to do that. But for instance, you know, I love hats. I love scarves. And I'll oftentimes especially wear a hat when I'm writing because it will just shift my mind a little bit into a different sort of persona.
Now, are you wearing a baseball cap? Are you wearing a derby? Are you wearing a cowboy hat?
I've got it all.
whatever mood strikes you.
We do have
a bowler.
We're here in the Bay Area, and they, you know, I mean, I can't buy as many hats as I'd like, but I do have a couple very kind of high-priced hats that are my favorites.
Now, do you have the pipe to go along with the certain hats?
I don't. I'm a non-smoker. maybe I should just chew on a unlit pipe. But
Yeah.
Children, so I don't want to role model any of that.
Oh, good point.
Yes, indeed.
So, Grant, you said that you came from Oskaloosa. When did you leave Iowa?
Well, in some ways, I've never left Iowa. honestly, I mean, my mind is still there. I write a lot of stories that take place in Iowa. I love Iowa. I technically left Iowa at least the first time when I was 22. I graduated from Grinnell College. I lived in Oskaloosa from my birth until I was 18. I returned later in my early 30s, and I worked for a spell, about a year, at the Des Moines Register. And my parents still live in Oskaloosa, so I come back a lot.
Oh, yeah. My grandfather went to Grinnell.
Oh, cool.
And your great-grandfather.
And my great-grandfather. Mm-hmm. Okay. Great school.
Yeah, it is a great school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you said you decided you wanted to be a writer when you were 20.
I did. That's when I officially kind of like announced it to myself and the world. You know, I've never honestly had a moment in my life where I didn't think of myself as a writer. When I was young, maybe like 4 years old, it was before I could read or write. I remember paging through some picture books in my bedroom alone. And somehow I had this epiphany, this whole big idea for a story and a series of stories, and I imagined it, and I was super excited, and I ran downstairs to tell my mom, and unfortunately my mom was on the phone with a friend of hers, and she just kept talking and talking and talking, and other than that one moment, she's been 100% supportive of my creative endeavors. That moment, it was kind of this interesting realization where, you know, sometimes the conversation you have with books as a writer, that is like kind of your primary conversation as a writer and as a creator. But, you know, when I was like 20 and going to Grinnell College, I was, you know, of course, having that moment of self-definition where, you know, it feels like the declaration of your major is like the declaration of your entire destiny in the world. You know, you're too young to realize how many times you can shift directions in your career. So I was deciding between being an econ major and an English major. And very fortunately, I was going on a study abroad program in France. And I say fortunately because I basically spent the whole semester sitting in cafes reading novels and writing in my journal. And I decided that was a pretty good lifestyle.
Now, have you found that fits with the working writer's lifestyle?
Well, it's not as glamorous. I don't get to, don't get to go to France and just sit and read novels in cafes or write in cafes. You know, I mean, being a writer, it does put you on certain precarious footing in terms of making a living. So I've done everything. I've worked in bookstores. I've waited tables. I've been a journalist, communications. I was an elevator man for a weekend once.
Oh.
I've detasseled corn, but that was before my writer days. But yeah, so I've always, you know, it's always a tough balance to figure out how to make a living and be a writer. It's definitely very challenging. But what's interesting, I think too many people, even with the career of being a writer, too many people put up obstacles and say, that's just too impractical, I can't do that. And I've found the opposite. I've found that interesting career pathways have opened because I'm a writer. So I can use my writing skills in a whole array of jobs. And you know, there's nothing more in the world that I'd love than to be a full-time writer just writing novels every day. But that's tough. That's very, very few people get to do that.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the ways that you have been able to work as a writer?
Yeah, well, it's always, you know, I mean, when I was in my 20s, it was great because I didn't have kids. I didn't have a house. Free. And so that's when I, you know, I would try to schedule or find jobs that allowed me to use my best time in the day to write, which is, I've always been a morning writer. And so I would write and read in the mornings and either work at a bookstore in the evenings or wait tables. And that's what I did with a good chunk of my 20s, definitely. And then after I got my MFA, I was, you know, I was in my late 20s by then, so I was a little bit more career-minded, and I taught writing at community college and for the University of Arizona. I was living in Arizona then. And then, yeah, it's just been, you know, I was a journalist at the Des Moines Register, and I worked in corporate communications for Charles Schwab, and then I found my way to the National Writing Project, which is this fantastic nonprofit that helps teachers teach writing better, and that's in Berkeley here. And then that led to the National Novel Writing Month. So I feel very blessed that I found jobs with organizations, nonprofit organizations that are all about writing. So at least I get to spend, when I'm not worried about fundraising or hiring staff or things like that, at least I get to spend a portion of my day thinking about creativity.
Mm.
And talking to people like you.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Grant Faulkner. He's the Executive Director of National Novel Writing Month, which is coming right up in November every year, and the author of Pep Talks for Writers. Let's talk a little bit more about some of the pep talks.
Yeah.
Do you have one that, like, if you're going to say, okay, if you're a writer, more than anything else, you need to read this one?
First and the last chapter, I think, and I'm not sure which one is more appropriate for this radio show here. Let me think. Let me just glance at the first one.
Well, I know you touch on the writer's block frequently in different aspects of it, and of course
here's one that it's been top of mind for me. The last chapter is all about what is success. And I think every person and every writer really needs to think about what is success. But there's also, I think a lot about so many writers that I've talked to, they have a hard time saying, I am a real writer.
Mm.
I feel like they're limiting themselves by not saying that. So I won't give away the whole chapter here, but let me just read this chapter. Is that all right?
Yeah,
great.
Okay, so it's like, the chapter's called You Don't Need Permission to Be a Creator. So each year I talk to hundreds of people who have perfected a peculiar and disturbing art, the art of telling themselves why they can't jump in and write the novel of their dreams. I've never taken any classes. I don't have an MFA. I have a lot of ideas for stories, but I'm not a real writer. Or, worst of all, they say, I'm not a creative type. I call this the other syndrome, as in other people do this, but not me. We've all been there, right? We open up the pages of a magazine and we read a profile of a magnificently cloaked and coiffed artistic being, a twirling scarf, moody eyes, locks of hair falling over a pensive brow. We read the witticisms and wisdom the celebrated artistic being dispenses while drinking a bottle of wine with a reporter one afternoon in a charming hamlet in Italy. The artistic being tells of creative challenges and victories achieved, and then drops in an anecdote or two about a conversation with a famous author, a good friend. There's a joke about a movie deal that fell through, and then an aside about the one that won an Oscar. There's talk about a recently published book, which called to them and gave them artistic fulfillment like no other book ever has. And as we sit in our house that is so very far from Italy, and we look across the kitchen, over the dishes on the counter, to the cheap bottle of wine from Safeway, and the phone rings with a call from a telemarketer, just as a bill slides off the stack of bills, we tell ourselves, other people are writers. Other people get the good fortune to have been born with a twirling scarf around their neck. To traipse to Italy to find a fantastic novel calling them. Other people get to be who they want to be, whether it's through family connections, blessed luck, or natural talent. But that's not me. That's other people. And you know what? We're right. The life of an artist is for others, because we just said so. And in saying so, we make it true. But here's the rub. Even after negating our creative potential, we're bound to wake up the next day to a tickle of an idea dancing in the far corner of our mind, a memory that is trying to push a door open, a strange other world that is calling us. We wash those dishes. We pay that stack of bills. We drink that cheap bottle of wine. But we know there's something else. We know there's something more. And there is something more. There's the creative life. You don't need a certificate for it. You don't need to apply to do it. You don't even need to ask permission to do it. You just have to claim it. You might not wear scarves in Italy, but you can make your own version of the artistic life, no matter where you live or what demands of life you face. It's not always easy, of course. There will be naysayers, those people who think it's silly or trivial to be a creative type, those who think it's audacious and pretentious for you to write a novel, those who think you can't do it because you lack the qualifications. You've decided to escape the mire of your creative slough, and sometimes that threatens others. But you're not embracing your creativity because it's an easy path. You're doing it because you have something to say. And no one gets to tell you that what you have to say doesn't matter because it matters to you. The arts don't belong to a chosen few. Quite the opposite. Every one of us is chosen to be a creator by virtue of being human. If you're not convinced of this, just step into any preschool and observe the unbridled creative energy of kids as they immerse themselves in finger painting, telling wild stories, banging on drums, and dancing just for the sake of dancing.
Mm-hmm.
They're creative types because they breathe. And you're a writer because you write. There's no other definition. Don't fall into the common trap of hesitating to call yourself a writer if you haven't published a book. It can easily happen. Agatha Christie said that even after she'd written 10 books, she didn't really consider herself a bona fide author. You earn your bona fides each time you pick up a pen and write your story. So start by telling yourself you're a writer. Then tell the world. Don't mumble it, be proud of it, because to be a writer takes moxie and verve. Your task as a human being and as an artist is to find that maker within, to decide that you're not other, you're a creator. Honor the impetus that bids you to write. Revere it, bow to it, hug it, bathe in it, nurture it. That impetus is what makes life meaningful. It's what makes you, you.
Mm-hmm. And you have a chapter called Trusting in the Absurd, and that's what I like about this book. There's so many things.
Yeah, Trusting in the Absurd is actually one of my favorite chapters.
It's certainly the
most fun to write.
Yeah.
And I do think, I mean, part of it is that I think we're trained to use the logic portion of our brain so much.
Uh-huh.
And so it's a chapter that really, really kind of urges people to do, you know, to explore the ridiculous parts of their brains, I guess, you know, to just have fun with words. And I think, like, as writers, we need to pause sometimes and just have fun with words as if we're finger painting, like we're in preschool. And so that's what that chapter is all about.
Now, Grant, I noticed that, you do a lot with very, very short fiction.
Yeah.
But you're also a novel writer.
Right.
So is it common for people to be able to play both ends of the fiction spectrum like that?
It's really interesting. I feel like sometimes writers, as all human beings do, we get kind of trapped in our identity. So if you're a sci-fi writer, you don't write horror, you don't write mystery, you don't write literary fiction, you write sci-fi. And I feel like we put up too many boundaries in life. I would learn a lot if I wrote a sci-fi novel. And I think, even though I am a little schizophrenic, I write mm-hmm. novels and I write nonfiction and I write these tiny little 100-word stories. Each form of writing really influences the other form. So I believe in breaking down the boundaries and really being fluid with your writer identity. And, you know, like I only recently started writing the 100-word stories. And just for your listeners, the stories had to be exactly 100 words. And I run a literary journal called 100 Word Stories online, 100wordstory.org. And what's interesting about writing a 100-word story is it's really more about editing than writing. And I say that because you're working within this compact little form, this box. And one reason I like it is that the constraints of that box bring out a different type of creativity. Like, you have to think about, how can I tell this story in such brevity? How can I communicate who the character is through hints and suggestions rather than really detailing, like, a character backstory? And how can I have that character change? How can there be a beginning, middle, and end to this little form? And for me, it invites, you know, that the power of suggestion, sometimes we forget that, of those of us who write longer forms, is that you create suspense by not revealing everything. And so the 100-word stories have really taught me to not tell so much, to leave in these white spaces in the story, these gaps, and to make what's left out help tell the story better.
Hmm.
I would say it takes some practice with that.
So exactly 100 words. It's
a challenge. And you know, to reply to your question just a little more deeply is that it is a huge challenge. And I when we first started the journal, I invited a number of, you know, well-published novelists to contribute 100-word stories, and several of them told me they could not do it. And I understand. I mean, I think as a writer, it's almost like we're like athletes, and some of us are trained for the 100-yard dash, and some of us are trained for marathons. But I think, like, you can retrain your brain, and that's what happened to me when I was writing these 100-word stories. I started out, and I could not get them down to 100 words. All my initial stories were like 150 words. But it is that practice of getting to exactly the 100 words is the challenge. And I think you can do it if you want it enough, like most things in life.
Well, even the 150 words fits in the definition of flash fiction, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. I mean, people have different definitions of flash fiction. I go with stories under 1,000 words. Some people say under 500 or under 750. The guy who coined the term flash fiction, James Thomas, his original intent was, the definition of flash fiction was something that you could read without turning a page.
Mm.
The story would fit on two pages of a book. I really like that definition.
Wow. We had a guest on Writer's Voices sometime not too long ago. David Goloff wrote Brevity, a Flash Fiction Handbook.
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very interesting. And I feel like those skills in writing flash fiction, like you say, they help make you a better writer in other areas too. Right.
You know, you have to choose just the exact word. You can't have any excess, you know. You have to pare things down to their fundamentals. And, you know, I think that that's just a really valuable writing skill, especially in these days with online, you know, writing things online. Brevity really, really helps you be effective.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. What are some of the other areas that you get into in Pep Talks for Writers?
Oh boy, I get into a lot of areas. I mean, like I say, it's really about developing a creative mindset, and that can happen on the page or beyond the page. And so, one chapter that I really like is embracing vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
I have a theory that the books that we love, it's not because the writer was necessarily so expert in the craft of creating suspense, or had a perfect plot line, or writes, you know, really compelling dialogue. I think the stories that really resonate with us, they really can't be taught. You know, how-to books they can't teach you how to write them, and that's because the writer needs to put his or her full heart into it and be very vulnerable on the page. Because what we look for in art and books are really connections with our heart, connections with other human beings. And that's tough to do. You know, you really do have to make yourself vulnerable on the page and question if something is holding you back from being as vulnerable as you can be.
Well, you know, we've always been told, write what you know.
Yeah.
And that's what holds some people back. Because
I think so, too. You know, I remember hearing that when I first became a writer, and I thought about it for years. I was like, what does this really mean? You know, and I think especially when you're a beginning writer, I felt like it very literally, like write what I know.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to basically write about my experiences in Oskaloosa.
Yeah.
Which was fine. Plenty of drama there.
But, yeah.
I think what write what you know means, it's more like being a method actor, where you're drawing on the emotions and the experiences that you've had, and you're infusing your characters and your stories with that. And I have a chapter on that addresses this, and the famous actress Shelley Winters, famous at least to those from a certain generation.
Yeah.
Poseidon Adventure, right?
Poseidon Adventure is one good Shelley Winters movie, yeah. She was a great method actress from the 50s and beyond. But she said, act with your scars. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what a writer has to do, is write with your scars. It doesn't necessarily have to be, you can write with your joys also.
Yes.
But, you know, the main purpose is like to get into yourself and really bring those experiences and those emotions to the surface. And in her case, it was acting with her scars on stage. I would say for us, it's like writing.
the chapter you have about be a beginner and watching someone learn to walk, I thought that was great.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I've you know, read a lot of Zen Buddhism, and that's where that concept of the beginner's mind comes from. And the way that it's defined is that, you know, a beginner is, like, so wonderfully open. Uh-huh. You know, like the more you know about something, the more you shut doors, and the more you kind of, like, define boundaries, and you become somewhat rigid if you become an expert.
Right.
And so it's hard to become a beginner. But I had this epiphany one day when my son was very young. I mean, in fact, he was just learning to walk, and I, you know, that thing of learning to walk, like, I probably couldn't even do that as an adult because I'd be so embarrassed every time I fell down.
Mm-hmm.
But he, you know, he didn't worry about what people thought of him. He was just experimenting with his body, and he wasn't discouraged when he fell down. He got right back up and you know, tried to walk again. And so I think there's a lot of learning. You know, we need to remind ourselves, especially as we become more and more expert in anything, to go back to the beginning, you know, and to think about what it was like to be a beginner. And I think that opens ourselves up to more experimentation and more bravery and taking chances and creating something new.
Excellent points.
Yes. Well, there's a lot of people that I have encountered. I was an English teacher for several years, but after that, I started a writer's group at my church, and they would say, "Oh, I can't write." And I said, "No, it's just like talking. You just write it down."
Yeah.
And they said, "Oh."
I mean, so many people say they can't write or they're not a writer. And I do think, I mean, that's what a lot of this book addresses, is all those myriad of obstacles that people put in between themselves and their creativity. And, you know, just per the chapter I just read about I Am a Writer, people declare themselves that they're not a writer, you know, and I think it's because they've unfortunately shut down that portion of themselves, the creative portion. Because I hear all the time people will say, "Oh, I can't do NaNoWriMo because I'm not a creative type." But, you know, we're creative types because we're humans. And writing, a lot of people don't think that they're writers because they haven't practiced it and they're not mm-hmm. published. But you can write for the sake of writing, you know, you can be creative for the sake of being creative. You don't have to have publishing as your end goal.
Of course, someone somewhere along the line, back in the day, told him, "You don't write very well."
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's the worst kind of scar. It's a creative scar.
Yeah.
Or creative wound, and I have a chapter in the book about that as well. And you know, there's it's funny because, like, going back to Picasso's definition that we're all born artists, but it's challenging to be an artist the older you get. And I think it's because we hear more naysayers as we get older. We hear more people saying, "No, you're not this," or we tell ourselves that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting. They say that when kids reach the fourth grade, that's when they start shutting down their artistic impulses. And part of that is because, you know, it's part of their brain development that if they're drawing a picture of a tree, for instance, they start to recognize how their drawing doesn't match exactly what the tree looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the moment when people start critiquing their artistic, you know, qualities or capabilities as well. And so, unfortunately, because people are measuring themselves against the standard of perfection, they're unfortunately shutting themselves down in an activity that enriches life.
I know so many little kids will say, I'm a great artist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great thing to believe. I have a chapter on that, too. It's called Be Deluded and Grand.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, and deluded, I mean that in quotes. It's just that I think we need to, saying that you're a great artist as a kid, how wonderful, you know?
Yeah.
Why not feel that your whole life? And I think as writers, no matter if we're best-selling authors or just beginning to write, you know, the gift is being able to put words on the page. So you are a great artist by doing that, by fulfilling yourself, by telling your story. And so I don't doubt that child who said that is a great artist.
Oh, that's my grandson.
Okay.
And he absolutely is.
Yeah. And you are because you're practicing an art. You know, you're doing something that is good for yourself. And I think we need more creators in the world. And that's part of the premise of National Novel Writing Month, is that everyone has a story to tell, not just some precious people. And the thing that happens, though, is that it's not just about writing a novel, but you become a change agent in your life and your community. you view things more creatively. So I think you're a better parent as a result. You're a better teacher. You're a better student. You're a better boss. You're a better employee. I think we need to nourish that creative side of ourselves to be better people.
And there are a lot of reasons other than publication to write. And writing has proven to be very effective therapy for people.
Yes.
Very effective at healing wounds.
Yeah.
There have been some studies. There was a study of nuns that kept journals, and it helped prevent Alzheimer's.
I saw that.
And dementia.
I heard about that.
Yeah.
We shouldn't. You know, I think writing for me is like the best critical thinking tool available. And going back to your earlier joke about pen and paper, this new technology.
Yeah.
I mean, writing is this new technology of critical thought. You can't download an app that helps you think critically about the world or imaginatively about the world as writing does. You know, it's a fantastic tool, and I think everyone. And we're living in what I call the golden age of writing, and I say that because this is where social media is good. If you look at Facebook, it's like one big stream of storytellers, and the better we are as writers, and the more confident we are, the more better we'll be able to communicate with people far and wide. On the internet.
That's true. Nowadays, I mean, people, basically, they might have been writing in a journal 30 years ago, and now they write it on Facebook, and they have an audience, and they're sharing it with people.
Increasingly, our journal writing has become less and less private with some people.
Yeah.
But when you're thinking about writing, helping your critical thinking, a lot of times, there are times when I really don't know what my opinion about something is until I kind of write through it.
Yeah, I know. I think like you unearth things by putting words on the page.
Yeah.
I think that's why some people even like they'll say they have writer's block or they don't have anything to write, but you know something magical happens when you put pen to paper or put your fingers on the keyboard. You write one sentence. It almost always leads to a second sentence and a third sentence. And once you create that momentum, you'll discover thoughts, or you'll discover a plot or a story that you didn't even think of you had in you.
I write, therefore I think.
Exactly.
Yeah.
is it important to, if you're writing a novel, is it important that you know in your mind what the outcome is going to be, what the characters are going to become or not become?
I think every writer is different, and there are a lot of writers, I think especially those who write genre or who write mystery, where they need to know a little bit more of the plot. They need to have things outlined and a little bit more defined.
Uh-huh.
I personally like to know the trajectory of the story, kind of the direction it's going in, but I don't like to have it overly planned or plotted, and that's because I like to write, I write for a sense of mystery. And the mystery is what's tugging me through the novel. And so I like to know things about my characters in the story, but if I know too much, I feel backed into a corner.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm writing towards the outline instead of the story. And especially in a rough draft, I think in a rough draft it is a way to plan your novel in some senses. You could call it a planning draft, and then your second draft might be the first draft. So I really think that opportunity for creative exploration is really valuable.
Now, we ask a lot of writers this question about, there seem to be two kind of schools of thought about writing. One is the, what I call the regurgitate school, where you get everything out as quickly as possible. And I think NaNoWriMo kind of leans towards that. You know, the first draft is bad. It's rough. It's, you don't do any editing. You just put it all out there, and then you go back and craft it from that point. But there are other very successful writers who write a different way, where they don't leave the page until, you know. Now it doesn't mean they aren't going to go back and change it again, but they're writing they're editing while they write.
Yeah. Well, I don't espouse. I don't say that one type of writing is better than another. I think that every writer has to find what works for him or her, and sometimes it's a blending of those two. So, for instance, in non-NaNoWriMo months, I write more slowly and more deliberately, but I just need to make sure that it's not too deliberate, that I'm not really slowing things down, because there is a lot to be said for getting words on the page. And for instance, like some mornings I'll have a deadline or an article assignment, and I will open up my laptop and be like, oh my gosh, I finally hit this moment where I cannot write this. But then I pinch myself and I say, just write something, just get something down, and you'll be, your future self tomorrow morning will be so happy that there are words to work with. And my future self is always happy and thanks my past self for writing those 500 or 1,000 words. But I think, again, like it's all about finding what works for you. And NaNoWriMo is a creative experiment, and I think people should enter it with that kind of mindset, and even experiment within the framework of NaNoWriMo, because everybody does it differently.
How long do you, on average, you think it takes people to write 1,700 words a day? Is that an hour?
For me, it's about 2 to 2.5 hours.
Okay.
I know some people who are much faster than that. I'm sure there are people who are slower too.
Yeah.
But I like to advise people, because I think it is good to really think ahead of NaNoWriMo, to think about, can you open up about 2 hours a day or more? But I say 2 hours a day is pretty good. That's not too burdensome for most people.
No. And of course, not all novels are 50,000 words. Some are shorter, some are longer.
Yes. So yeah, 50,000 words is just for the sake of, it's a ballpark estimate of what a manageable novel is in a month.
Now, is there any contest aspect to this? Like any prizes if you...
Well, there's this fantastic prize that we give away every year, and it's called Your Novel. And you get this wonderful, magical gift every year that you got to be creative for a month and write your novel.
Mm.
And beyond that, the other prizes are very secondary. But we do celebrate you as a winner. You get a variety of winner goodies from our sponsors. But mainly you get the self-satisfaction that you did a huge creative act, and you did it within a community of other people.
Wow.
You got to connect with them.
I think this self-publishing trend has encouraged a lot of people to try that might not have ever done it before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've worked with a number of self-publishing sponsors, or we do every year. I think self-publishing, I think the interesting thing about it for me, it is fantastic because it really is a gate crasher.
Mm-hmm.
Those gates in around New York City publishing houses are, you don't need to go through them anymore, because you can self-publish if you want to. It does take, I think, there is a learning curve to it. Because you are doing all of it yourself, more or less, even if you do hire an editor or hire a cover designer, you're making all those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And you're investing in your own book. But that said, I think like the wonderful part of that is that your creative journey, and I do think like after you've finished your novel, it is a creative journey. You're still on that journey. And you're using your creativity and your vision of the book to think about what's the best cover design for this? How am I going to market it? How am I going to reach people with it? So I think I don't like to divide books into the creative side and the business side, especially when it comes to self-publishing.
Because it is all creative. That's true.
It's all creative.
Yeah.
And the marketing too. It's all part of like extending this wonderful novel you've written. And extending it into the world.
Well, like you said, we are all creative just by virtue of being human. There have been years in my life where I don't have time to write at all, but I've been busy creating jobs because I'm an entrepreneur.
Exactly. And, that's what we're living in. This. I mean, the whole thing about our country is that it's founded in creativity and innovation, and it's that spirit has guided us, throughout our history. But I think we can always ramp it up, and I think there are too many people who don't see themselves as creators or creative, and so that's part of our mission.
Absolutely.
And where can we get your book? How can we find your book?
I think all of the normal booksellers have it, whether it's Barnes & Noble or Amazon.
Okay.
or another online channel. It's published by Chronicle Books, so you can also get it on there.
And Chronicle Books is a wonderful publisher.
No problem finding it.
Yeah, and I see it's also available on the NaNoWriMo website.
Thank you for reminding me of that. Yes. Yeah, the NaNoWriMo website. So if you buy it on our NaNoWriMo website, the proceeds actually, or part of the proceeds, go to our nonprofit. And I actually signed all of those books.
Oh, right. Right.
I mean, I can't really say enough about this book, that anybody who thinks they might like to write or is a writer and wants to hone their skills, this is the book.
We only have a few minutes left, Grant, and if you're just catching us here at the end, this is Grant Faulkner, author of Pep Talks for Writers, and we're listening to Writers' Voices. If you're listening to us on Friday, it rebroadcasts Monday morning at 8 a.m.
So tell your friends, yeah. Because it's...
just real quickly, Chronicle Books. I find the books from Chronicle to be among the most beautiful books I've ever seen.
They really are. They put so much care and attention and imagination into their book design and their cover design. And they make things so wonderfully fun and spirited. So I can't say enough about them as a publisher.
And how did you connect with them?
You know, ironically, they are located here in the Bay Area in San Francisco. I connected with them in part because my agent, you know, is connected with them, and she's connected with them because she represents Chris Beatty, the founder of NaNoWriMo, and he's published his books with them.
Right.
Really just coincidence.
So your path to publication was fairly seamless, sounds like, for this book.
Yeah, you know, I guess with this book, it was relatively seamless.
But you've had rockier paths with the previous books?
Oh, yeah. I will have rockier future books. That's just part of the deal.
How long did you work on this one?
You know, I probably, I work on so many different things at once. It's hard for me to, you know, while I was writing this, I was also writing short stories and working on a novel. But probably about a year.
Wow. Well, Grant,
proposal and actually writing the chapters and then going through edits.
It's a great book, highly recommended for writers. We're out of time. So thank you so much for being with us today. Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
I do. One of the greatest pleasures in life is achieving what others say you cannot achieve.
Wow. Stay tuned now if you're listening on Friday for Planet Earth's Wild, and see you next week on Writers' Voices. Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.